CA, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
Hello, everybody. We're Stereolab.
And my name's Tim.
And I'm Laetitia.
And you're listening to...
CFRC.
The best radio station we've ever heard.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
On Saturday, September 21st, two perennial powerhouse programs in the OUA will go toe-to-toe at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Your Queens Gaels will host the Guelph Griffins. Last year, the Gaels and the Griffins waged war in a classic contest that went down to the wire. Can the Griffins get their revenge, or will the Gaels stay golden at Richardson Stadium? There's only one way to find out, and that's to tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Join us for our pregame show at 2:45 p.m. Kickoff is scheduled for 3. Trust me, folks, you don't want to miss this one.
Agnes Etherington Art Center welcomes new and returning students for Orientation Week activities. From September 16th to the 21st, join Agnes for queer karaoke, a film screening by Palestinian filmmaker Kamal Al-Jafari, an educator workshop prioritizing a no-border approach to teaching, and an exclusive sound-making workshop with renowned musical collective, LOL. To register for any of these free events, visit the Agnes website at agnes.queensu.ca.
Now.
At around 3:30 p.m. this afternoon, a large number of injuries started flowing into the hospitals. Those injured were primarily hurt after the explosion of communication tools, pagers, that they were carrying.
In Lebanon, at least 12 people were killed and over 2,800 injured when electronic pagers used by members of Hezbollah exploded across the country at the same time. Hezbollah blamed Israel, vowed to retaliate as fears grow of a broader regional war. We'll go to Beirut, Geneva, and Boston for the latest. Then ProPublica has revealed at least two women have died in Georgia after they could not access legal abortions and timely medical care. Vice President Kamala Harris brought up their stories while addressing the National Association of Black Journalists.
I don't know if anyone here has heard most recently the stories out of Georgia. Tragic story about a young woman who died because it appears the people who should have given her health care were afraid they'd be criminalized after the Dobbs decision came down.
We'll speak to an editor at ProPublica and Monica Simpson of Sister Song, based in Georgia. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, at least 12 people were killed, nearly 3,000 people injured Tuesday afternoon when electronic pagers used by members of Hezbollah exploded at the same time at 3:30 in the afternoon. The simultaneous blast set off fear and panic in Beirut and across southern Lebanon and left hospitals overwhelmed. Hezbollah blamed Israel, vowed to retaliate, raising fears of a broader regional war. Reuters reports Israel's Mossad spy agency managed to plant explosive devices in pagers bought in recent months by Hezbollah from a company in Taiwan. Victims of the attack included a 10-year-old girl named Fatima Jafar Abdullah, who was killed when her father's pager exploded. Iran's ambassador to Lebanon, Mojtaba Amani, lost an eye to an exploding pager. pressure. Hezbollah relied on pagers for communication in part to avoid Israel's surveillance of other communication networks. Lebanese lawmakers condemn the attack as an act of terrorism. After headlines, we'll go to Beirut, to Geneva, and Boston for the latest. Top Biden administration officials quickly distanced themselves from Tuesday's pager attack in Lebanon. This is State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
I can tell you that the U.S. was not involved in it. The U.S. was not aware of this incident in advance, and at this point, we're gathering information.
On Tuesday, Vice President Kamala Harris defended the Biden administration's support of Israel throughout its assault on Gaza. During an interview with the National Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia, Harris also cited her support for President Biden's decision in May to temporarily pause the delivery of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. Harris was questioned by reporter Eugene Daniels of Politico.
But what do you say to those that say that's not enough, that stopping the 2,000-pound bombs the one time wasn't enough, that this administration, your possible administration, has to do more?
Well, we are doing the work of putting the pressure on all parties involved to get the deal done. But let me be very clear also. I support Israel's ability to defend itself.
Just last month, the Biden administration approved $20 billion in additional weapon sales to Israel, including advanced air-to-air missiles and fighter jets. In Gaza, at least 20 Palestinians have been killed and 54 wounded over the past 24 hours, including at least 8 people who were killed in an Israeli airstrike targeting a school sheltering displaced civilians in Gaza City's Shijaya neighborhood. Another attack on a civilian car near Rafah in southern Gaza killed 2 Palestinians and wounded several others. The United Nations is warning Burma is plumbing the depths of a human rights abyss as the military regime intensifies the killings and arbitrary arrests of tens of thousands of civilians since seizing power in a coup over 3 years ago. The gruesome findings were part of a new report by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, which detailed that many of those detained by the Burmese military are children taken from their parents. Dozens of those children have died in custody. This is UN Rights Office spokesperson Liz Thrasson.
Since the coup on the 1st of February 2021, at least 5,350 civilians have been killed, more than 3.3 million displaced, and over half the population are living below the poverty line, primarily due to military violence.
Lawmakers in the Republic of Georgia have approved legislation to begin a sweeping crackdown on LGBTQIA people and organizations. The so-called Family Values and the Protection of Minors Law, approved Tuesday, will outlaw pride events, LGBTQ plus gatherings, and even displays of rainbow flags. Tamar Jakeli is director of Tbilisi Pride in Georgia's capital.
Our main aim was always to be very outspoken and loud on LGBTQ issues. Every year we used to hold a Pride Week. We tried to hold Pride marches. We held successfully Pride festivals, conferences, and film screenings. And now we are already at the risk that we cannot hold any events, really. And this law will make it legally impossible, not just physically and politically impossible, but also legally.
Back in the United States, Republican senators have once again blocked legislation that would protect access to in vitro fertilization and require health insurers to cover the fertility treatment. The Right to IVF Act was sponsored by Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth, who personally struggled to become pregnant before turning to IVF to conceive her children.
Now, that freedom to get reproductive care is at risk for millions of other women whose most desperate hope in the world is to have a little one of their own. Make no mistake, that isn't some future nightmare. This is our present reality.
In more reproductive rights news, ProPublica reports at least two women in Georgia died after they could not access legal abortions and timely Medicare in their state. Amber Thurman suffered a fatal infection after doctors refused to treat a rare complication from a medication abortion. And Candy Miller died from medication abortion complications after her family said she didn't visit a doctor, quote, due to the current legislation on pregnancies and abortions. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. In Texas, hundreds of homes remain under evacuation orders in the Houston suburb of Deer Park, more than 2 days after an SUV struck a pipeline valve station, triggering a massive explosion that rattled homes and businesses, sending a column of fire and smoke into the sky that was visible more than 10 miles away. The pipeline containing natural gas liquids burned for a second straight day and into the night Tuesday. Here in New York, music mogul Sean Diddy Combs was denied bail and remain in jail until his trial after pleading not guilty Tuesday to racketeering, conspiracy, sex trafficking, and other charges. Prosecutors accused Combs of repeatedly assaulting several women, drugging and coercing women and men to perform sexual acts, and being part of a criminal organization that engaged in sex trafficking, forced labor, kidnapping, arson, bribery, and other crimes since at least 2008. He'll appear in court again today. In Atlanta, prosecutors on Tuesday dropped all money laundering charges against three activists who were accused of misusing a bail fund to support protests against Cop City, a multi-million dollar police training complex. It will be the largest in the country. Atlanta Solidarity Fund organizers Marlon Coutts, Adele McLean, and Savannah Patterson are still facing racketeering charges as part of a sweeping RICO case that includes at least 58 other Stop Cop City activists indicted last year. Advocates celebrated the victory, writing in a statement, quote, "From the beginning, we knew these charges were not based on any evidence, but were instead politically motivated and intended to target a social movement," they said. And in Washington, D.C., the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the rise of anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic hate crimes across the United States. Republican senators used the forum to condemn recent student-led pro-Palestine protests at university campuses across the country and lashed out at the hearing's Arab American witness, Maya Berry, executive director of the Arab American Institute. This is Louisiana Republican Senator John Kerry questioning Barry.
I think it's exceptionally disappointing that you're looking at an Arab American witness before you and saying you support Hamas.
You know what's disappointing to me?
I do not support Hamas.
Bring yourself
I do
to
not
say
support Hamas.
You don't
or
support
any...
UNRWA. You don't support Hamas. You don't
I was very clear in my support for UNRWA.
Hezbollah. You don't
I
support
oppose...
Iran. You should hide your head in a bag.
You support Hamas, don't you? Asked the Louisiana Senator John Kennedy repeatedly as he conflated the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, with Hamas. Following that exchange, committee chair Democratic Senator Dick Durbin gave Maya Berry a chance to respond.
It's regrettable that I, as I sit here, have experienced the very issue that we're attempting to deal with today. The introduction of foreign policy is not how we keep Arab Americans or Jewish Americans or Muslim Americans or Black people or Asian Americans, anybody safe. This has been regrettably a real disappointment, but very much an indication of the danger to our democratic institutions that we're in now.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, in Lebanon, at least 12 people were killed and over 2,800 people injured Tuesday when electronic pagers exploded across the country. We'll go to Boston, Beirut, and Geneva. Stay with us.
قال إنه غني عم يعطي فقير كأنه المصاري أشاطر لحالة عايدة نتفي وايدة كتير حلو
This is by the Lebanese composer and pianist Ziad Rabbani. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, at least 12 people were killed, over 2,800 injured Tuesday, when electronic pagers used by members of Hezbollah exploded at the same time. It was about 3:30 in the afternoon. Israel's widely believed to be behind the attack. Hezbollah vowed to retaliate against Israel as fears grow of a broader regional war. According to a report by Reuters, Israel's Mossad spy agency had managed to plant explosive material in a batch of pagers bought in recent months by Hezbollah. The pagers were sold under the name of the Taiwanese brand Gold Apollo, but the company said the pagers were actually made by a firm in Budapest that had a license to use Gold Apollo name. Victims of the attack included a 10-year-old girl who died when her father's pager exploded. The Iranian ambassador to Lebanon, Mujtaba Amani, was also injured by an exploding pager. The New York Times reports he lost an eye in the blast. The nature of the simultaneous attack shocked many in Lebanon.
What happened yesterday shocked us. It was unimaginable. No one could have thought that pagers could explode like that. The scene was shocking, how people were torn apart right in front of you.
Hezbollah relied on pagers in part to avoid Israel's surveillance of other communication networks like cell phones. Lebanese lawmaker Tony Frange Jr. condemned the attack as an act of terrorism.
Catastrophic repercussions for the crisis today, but this, as I have previously explained with several stations, is terrorism being practiced against Lebanon. And we, and I believe the majority of the Lebanese people, do not submit to the language of terrorism.
Earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken said the U.S. did not know about nor was involved in what he called, quote, these incidents. Blinken made the comments in Cairo, Egypt, where he held a joint news conference with the Egyptian foreign minister and met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Axios reports Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant called U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin shortly before the operation began. We go now to Beirut, Lebanon, where we're joined by independent Lebanese journalist Mohammed Klait. Thanks so much for being with us. Mohammed, can you describe the scene yesterday at 3:30?
Thank you very much for having me. We're still in a sort of state of shock of what happened. We didn't comprehend what was going on until later hours at night. What happened at 3:30, sounds of small explosions were happening in the streets of the southern suburbs specifically. People yelling at the street. People were in state of shock. There were some of them who were not targeted by this terrorist attack were in a state of they were frozen in the streets, not knowing what was going on. It was very hard to comprehend, to make sense of what was happening. Then later on, people started helping the people who were injured, where these pagers exploded on their waists or even their hands or in front of their faces, taking them to hospitals because they were falling down on the street by the thousands. As the Minister of Health has counted, around 1,850 persons were injured in the southern suburbs alone, or in Beirut in general. There were around 2,000 persons who were admitted to hospitals, around 450 persons who were critically injured in the faces and the eyes. While on the street, people until now are still making sense of what was happening. Even until late at night, people were still on the streets, still trying to get people who were injured from their houses, from the cafes, from the supermarkets, from all the civilian buildings where these pagers have exploded, trying to admit them to hospitals, trying to donate blood for those who have lost it.
And the number of people killed and wounded, and the people who were killed, we just reported on an 8-year-old girl. Can you go more into this, Mohammed?
Yes. So far, there have been 13 persons who were killed. 10 of them who are direct personnel of Hezbollah, whether they be affiliated with Hezbollah or they might be contractors as well, because from what and there are also three other civilians, a mother and the little girl that you talked about, who is I think she's 9 years old, and there's also a young boy who's 11 years old who passed away late at night. Hezbollah, from what I know, that these pagers are used by Hezbollah, basically by the people who are medics, who work in logistics, not the people who work, a very few of them who work in the military sector of Hezbollah use these pagers.
I'd like to bring a guest into the conversation who is an expert on investigating human rights abuses, Ramzi Kais, Human Rights Watch researcher, investigating human rights abuses in Lebanon. He's joining us from Geneva. Ramzi, thanks so much for being with us. Can you explain what you understand technically happened and talk about it in the context of an international human rights framework?
Thanks, Amy, and thanks for having me. As you noted, and as Mohammed noted, yesterday there was scenes of just chaos and shock in Lebanon as thousands of pagers exploded simultaneously across the country, resulting in thousands of people being injured. According to the Ministry of Health, at least 12 people have been killed. This includes 2 children and aid workers, and at least 2,800 people have been injured. Now, photos and videos that we reviewed that were taken by witnesses to the attack or victims showed pagers exploding in public places such as grocery stores or supermarkets, and other videos that appeared to be linked to the attack that took place, taken from emergency rooms, showed adults and children in emergency rooms with truly severe, traumatic, and penetrating injuries. We saw injuries to the head, to the torso, to the limbs, with many people who had decapitated fingers, in addition to other injuries that appear to be consistent with the detonation of high explosives. Now, we know that Hezbollah, in a statement that they issued, said that these pages had belonged to various units and institutions within Hezbollah. They blamed the Israeli government. And we know from the various media reports that have come out, with citing Israeli, former Israeli officials and U.S. officials saying that Israel is responsible for the attack. But the Israeli military has not commented as of yet, at least according to my knowledge. Look, certainly there needs to be a full and prompt investigation into how the attack unfolded that should be conducted. But what we know from the perspective of international humanitarian law on the way in which this attack took place, the law of armed conflict is clear. It prohibits the use of booby traps or other apparently harmless portable devices that civilians could be attracted to or that civilians use precisely in order to avoid the harm that we saw unfold in Beirut yesterday with the devastating scenes of thousands of people being rushed to the hospital at the same time, including children, including civilians. When an explosive device is used or implanted in something such as a pager, where this device, its location cannot be reliably determined, where the means of attack or the method in which the attack takes place cannot differentiate or between civilians or combatants, it cannot be directed at a specific military target, and which would strike military targets and civilians alike without distinguishing between them. This is an unlawfully indiscriminate attack, and is unlawful under the laws of war. And there needs to be accountability for this violations and for other violations, because as we've seen, there has been continued impunity for violations of the laws of war in Lebanon. Human Rights Watch has documented apparently deliberate attacks on civilians, on journalists, indiscriminate attacks on civilians, widespread use of white phosphorus included on populated areas, and the use of U.S. weapons unlawfully against aid workers. And without accountability for such violations, they will continue with impunity. We've previously called on various countries such as the U.S. And other countries to suspend arms sales and military assistance to Israel in light of the fact that they could be used unlawfully in violations of IHL, as we are seeing unfold in the country.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden tweeted following the attacks, quote, "What Israel has just done is, via any method, reckless. They blew up countless numbers of people who were driving, meaning cars out of control, shopping, your children are in the stroller standing behind them in the checkout line, etc. Indistinguishable from terrorism." Ramzi, your response.
Yeah, I mean, in the videos that we reviewed, you could clearly see these devices go off in supermarkets where civilians were nearby, the children were nearby, and the attacks happened at the same time. And so when you use explosive devices that are not able to distinguish between or specifically target a military object, and they're indiscriminate and could cause harm to civilians as well as to military target, that would amount to an indiscriminate attack, and that is unlawful under the laws of war, and should be investigated as a violation of IHL. And for those reasons, there needs to be not just an investigation, but accountability for such violations, or we will continue to see violations unfold with impunity.
On Tuesday, European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell warned about the risk of a broader regional war.
I was in Lebanon before coming to Emirates. I was visiting the United Nations troops in the border. When I came there, the level of danger was increasing, and I see the troops going to their barracks. Certainly, there is a possibility of the war be spilling over, not only to Lebanon, but also it's already being an important fire in the Red Sea, where we, the European Union, has deployed a Navy mission in order to protect the freedom of navigation. The risk of a spillover is not from yesterday, it's from the beginning. And we have to do all our efforts in order to try to avoid the regionalization of the war in Gaza.
So that's Josep Borrell, EU chief, the European Union. Rami Khoury is also with us in Boston, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. Rami, you have repeatedly said you do not believe what was happening in Gaza would lead to a broader regional war. What are your thoughts today on what happened yesterday and where this is all headed?
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, there are so many dimensions to this, and most of the discussion that we're all involved in is based on speculation and assumptions. We have to be really careful to wait till we get verifiable facts, and then we can have a better idea. But for the moment, I think I would say the following. I still believe that Hezbollah, Israel, Iran, Hamas and others want to avoid a all-out, you know, free-for-all war between people in the region, which would probably include the U.S. if Iran gets involved. We saw a couple of months ago that Israel cannot defend itself by itself. It needs Arab support. It needs big-time American support on the spot. And it needs significant aid of money and weapons and other things. So I still believe an all-out regional war is going to be avoided because everybody realizes it wouldn't solve anything. It would just create massive suffering and more openings for terror groups and armed non-state actors as well, etc. That's what happens when you have chaos. What we do have is a regional low-intensity conflict going on. It's been going on for about a year or so. And Hezbollah and Israel are the key points of this, but Hamas is involved, the Ansarullah, the Houthis in Yemen are involved, and others. Iran indirectly is involved, and the U.S. indirectly through Israel is involved. What the Israeli attack using the pagers did is completely throw out the rule book on two things. One, as the previous guest said, the rules of war are irrelevant. They've always been irrelevant to Israel and the Zionist movements before the creation of Israel. They've done whatever they needed to do, they say, to protect themselves. The world says there's rules of wars to deal with that. But the Israelis have always ignored it. But they've also now thrown out the rules of engagement that Hezbollah and Israel have applied really since 2006, the last big war between them. I was in Beirut for that, and I experienced it. And I know the feeling that's prevalent all over Lebanon now is something I've experienced several times. And that was the point of what the Israelis wanted to do. They wanted to traumatize and terrorize the entire civilian population. They wanted to shock the Hezbollah institutions, and they wanted to basically destabilize the country to the point where if the Israelis wanted to go into South Lebanon in a big way, they would lay the groundwork for that. But at the same time, I think you have to keep remembering, in the last 3-4 months, we've had Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Israel, and the Ansarullah in Yemen with their supersonic missile or whatever it's called, the big-time missile that went right into Israel undetected from Yemen. They've all been broadcasting, showcasing their technical capabilities. In other words, sending a message to the other that we want to avoid a full war because we have huge capabilities that we haven't used yet, and this is something you all want to avoid. Israel just did its part in that drama, showing the capabilities that it has. The thing that is fascinating to me and important and still unclear is that Israel had to prepare for this months and months ahead of time, and we'll get more details on that soon. But this suggests that this kind of an operation was probably the prelude to a big land and air attack, I'm assuming, but because they wouldn't just do this by itself and drop it probably, but we'll see. We don't know the details. But the Israelis have talked about Hezbollah for several years as their main threat, their main concern in the region. Hamas and other are secondary. They see Hezbollah both as a threat because of its power and its disruption in the north of Israel, and because of its very direct links with Iran. And they've talked about trying to break it up, destroy it, push it back from the border. They keep coming up with all kinds of different ideas, none of which are clear, and almost none of which are within its capabilities. There's so many unknown factors, but we can say that all sides have tremendous capabilities, technological and other. They're prepared to use them. They're prepared to risk an all-out war in the region, which they would try to contain in the region without getting, say, the U.S. and Iran involved. And we don't know if this is all, if the Israelis did this mainly to put pressure on the Lebanese and Hezbollah to accept the Israeli terms for the new terms of engagement, which is to push Hezbollah back from the Lebanon-Israel border about 10 miles or so. It's possible that this is just a short-term measure that Israel is trying to achieve. So I think we have to take all of these things into consideration. The last point I make is nothing that happened yesterday and today, or in the last few months, is really new. But the scale of it is much bigger than anything that's happened before. Israel and Hezbollah and others have used technology to kill each other and terrorize each other for decades. Terrorizing civilians is a stable Israeli policy for many years. None of it is really new, but the scale of it now is what's kind of scary. And because the Israel-U.S. combination is now actively exchanging fire with five or six parties all around the Middle East and facing a huge global swell of support for a ceasefire in Gaza and for a Palestinian state, serious political pressures that might even influence the American presidential election outcome, possibly in the swing states. These are signs that the scale of the actions and the scale of the consequences are far higher than ever before. And if you take it, you say, why is this? I would say this: the one main reason. There are many, but the one main reason is that the U.S. and the Western world has allowed the right-wing Israeli governments of the last 15, 20 years to do anything they want in terms of settlements, imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, killing people, now a plausible genocide. Israel can do anything it wants, kill as many people, ignore as many laws, terrorize as many people as it wants, dehumanize as many people as it wants. It will suffer no consequences. This is something quite extraordinary, and the world has to somehow come to grips with this.
I wanted to go back to Beirut for a moment. Victims of Israel's pager attack included, I guess she's 10 years old, a little girl named Fatima Jaffer Abdullah, killed when her father's pager exploded. And now also confirmed, a young boy named Bilal Khanj has not survived his injuries after the Israeli pager attack in Lebanon. He becomes the second child to be killed. And I wanted to go back to the journalist Mohammed Klait to ask about how widespread these pagers are in Lebanon and about the use of pagers specifically to avoid Israel's surveillance of specifically cell phones.
Okay, so there are two catches in this. The first part is that This new batch that Hezbollah has ordered for these pagers, as you have mentioned before, that it's a Taiwanese-made pager, but they got it from a Bulgarian company that uses the same name of the Taiwanese company or has the rights to use the name. As the investigations or journalistic investigations have shown that Israel has intercepted this cargo of around 4,000 to 5,000 pagers, and they have tampered with it and detonated them alongside placing eavesdropping devices inside of them. And as Dr. Khoury has mentioned, that it was a weapon that they wanted to use during a full-on scale attack or maybe a land attack on Lebanon. But as we have seen 2 days ago, this plot was exposed by certain technicians in Hezbollah, and and you know, my personal sources have said that because this plot was exposed, and they were working on getting rid of them, and during an investigation that they were doing on these pages, that's why Israel has detonated these pages in a sudden way and caused this chain attack on people and on civilians and military personnel of Hezbollah. And
Mohammed, just a quick correction. It was a Budapest-based, it was a Hungary-based company. I'm looking at the Reuters report. The model of pagers used in detonations in Lebanon were made by a Budapest-based BAC Back Consulting. Yes. The Taiwanese pager firm Gold Apollo said on Wednesday, adding it had only licensed out its brand to the company and was not involved in the production of the devices. But keep going, Mohammed.
Yes, I'm sorry. I think I said Bulgaria, not Budapest. Yeah, and as for the second part, why do they still use the pagers? Hezbollah's General Secretary Hassan Nasrallah has said before that there's a huge danger in using cell phones, smartphones that are connected to the Wi-Fi and to global internet, on the safety of the combatants of Hezbollah in the south, as well as the civilian usage of these phones when they are filming in videos the locations of where the missiles and the rockets are coming out and in the fields and in the valleys and so on, because this is when it's being spread on social media or being distributed and shared on WhatsApp or other applications, this is giving intelligence information for the Israelis, which is whom are later on bombing these locations of the videos that are being widespread. So there were internal orders by Hezbollah to not use smartphones, to try to disconnect them when possible from the internet and from the Wi-Fi connections. So they have relied on these on this new batch of pagers that they had, but as I've mentioned, that they were tampered with and intercepted and tampered with by the Israeli Mossad and we saw what happened yesterday.
And are people still going to hospitals to give
and
blood?
And I wanted to also... And I just wanted to add something for what Mr. Kais has said concerning that Israel is using booby traps, which are illegal based on international law. That during the 90s, I still remember when we used to go to the south during the Israeli occupation of the southern Lebanon, Israel used to drop baby toys that were booby traps, and they have small explosive devices. They used to drop them from military helicopters in the valleys, on the streets of the villages where little kids were used to pick them up, and then they would explode. That's why we have seen many people from my generation from the 90s that they are either arms are amputated or they are missing a leg because of this illegal usage or illegal forms of warfare. Mm.
And the hospital, the issue of the hospitals and people going to give blood. Again, thousands and thousands of people have been injured, nearly 3,000, it's believed at this point, Mohammed. Mm.
Yes, and as I mentioned earlier, that these pagers are used by medical personnel, logistics, some of the military personnel of Hezbollah. I know some of the persons that I talked to yesterday that they were at a clinic, and two of the doctors had these pagers and they blew up on their waist. One of them had his fingers amputated. The other had minor injuries. And we've seen this huge influx of people trying to donate blood because, as the Ministry of Health has said, there are roughly 2,800 persons who were injured, as I mentioned as well, 1,850 only in Beirut. The huge state of chaos or medical chaos that we have seen in the city, particularly, is out of this world. It's sort of like something from a sci-fi movie. But we have seen this huge state of cohesion and support from Lebanese in general, that they have went from, they came from different parts of the country, from far sides of the country, just to donate blood. Doctors and nurses came from bordering areas to the city and to Baalbek in the east, and also to Nabatiya and Tyre in the south, to support the hospitals because they had a shortage of medical staff. And also to donate blood for the people who were injured, creating these blood banks in the streets, as we have also are seeing today, because it's a huge case of chaos, and sadly we don't have the proper medical infrastructure because of the crises that we have been through since 2019, and there's no proper plan of emergency to be implemented by the government. So people are trying to organize themselves in order to ease the crisis that we are in right now.
Well, Mohammed Kleita, I want to thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, Lebanese journalist. Ramzi Kais, Human Rights Watch researcher, thank you as well for joining us from Geneva, investigating human rights abuses in Lebanon. And Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, speaking to us from Boston, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut. Of course, we'll continue to follow this story. Coming up, ProPublica has revealed at least two black women died in Georgia after they could not access legal abortion and timely medical care. Vice President Harris brought up their stories while addressing the National Association of Black Journalists yesterday. We'll speak with a ProPublica editor working on the story and a Georgia reproductive justice activist with Sister Song. Stay with us. Lebanese musician and ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at reproductive rights in the United States, which are a key issue in this presidential election now less than 50 days away. On Tuesday, Republican senators once again blocked legislation to protect access to IVF, in vitro fertilization, and require health insurers to cover the fertility treatment after Democrats forced a vote. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris slammed Donald Trump, her Republican rival, for his role in abolishing national abortion rights after he appointed three of the Supreme Court justices who issued the Dobbs ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. In an interview yesterday with the National Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia, Vice President Harris cited the case reported by ProPublica of Amber Thurman, a 28-year-old black woman in Georgia who died from a fatal infection after doctors refused to treat a rare complication from a medication abortion.
I don't know if anyone here has heard most recently the stories out of Georgia. A tragic story about a young woman who died because it appears the people who should have given her health care were afraid they'd be criminalized after the Dobbs decision came down. Laws that make no exception even for rape or incest, which means that you're telling a survivor of a crime of a violation to their body that they have no right to make a decision about what happens to their body next, which is immoral. an approach that doesn't take into account that most people, I think, agree you don't have to abandon your faith or deeply held beliefs to agree the government should not be telling her what to do with her body.
Georgia's Maternal Mortality Review Committee found Amber Thurman's death was preventable and largely due to delays in care. This comes as Project 2025 staffer, former Trump White House personnel chief John McEntee, doubted the danger of abortion bans in a TikTok post last Thursday.
Can someone track down the women Kamala Harris says are bleeding out in parking lots because Roe v. Wade was overturned? Don't hold your breath.
McEntee was widely ridiculed as women posted responses about their experiences being denied care. Well, today, ProPublica published a new report on a second woman in Georgia who died from medical abortion complications. Candy Miller's family said she didn't visit a doctor, quote, due to the current legislation on pregnancies and abortions, unquote. Overall, deaths due to complications from abortion pills are extremely rare. For more, we're joined by two guests. Monica Simpson is with us. She's executive director of Sister Song, the National Woman of Color Reproductive Justice Collective based in Georgia. And Ziva Brandstetter is also joining us from Walnut Creek, California, senior editor at ProPublica, who helped edit two new reports by Kavitha Sarana. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Ziva. Vice President Harris cited your investigation in her answers to questions from the National Association of Black Journalists yesterday. Can you lay out the stories of Amanda Thurman, and also today you just broke a new story on the second death?
Correct. Well, thank you, first of all, Democracy Now!, for having me on to talk about the reporting by ProPublica and reporter Kavitha Sarana. We have reported two stories. Both deaths of these women occurred in the months following the overturn of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. Both were in Georgia. Both were African-American women. The first case, Amber Thurman, 28-year-old single mother with a 3-year-old son. She died after doctors did not provide care over about a 20-hour period in the emergency room. She had taken abortion medication to end her pregnancy, and fetal tissue remained, which is a very rare complication of taking abortion medication, very simply solved with a procedure called a DNC that doctors did not provide over 20 hours in the emergency room. That procedure in almost all cases in Georgia now and in other abortion ban states is a felony. Doctors could face criminal prosecution for performing it. We don't know what was going through their minds, but they did not operate over 20 hours, and she died in August of 2022. The story that we just published today on ProPublica's website is about Candy Miller, a 41-year-old woman, also from Georgia, mother of three, who also self-managed her abortion at home, which is becoming far more regular under abortion bans. She took abortion medication, again, rare complication. Instead of going to the hospital, she was afraid to seek care and did not, and died at home with a mixture of drugs that her family believes was trying to manage the pain. And she died as well in November of 2022. That death has been ruled by the state preventable. And not only that, directly related to the state's abortion ban, which is the first time we've seen this reported.
And explain the abortion ban in Georgia.
Correct. It's a 6-week ban. We classify that almost the same as a complete ban, because many people who can become pregnant don't know at that point that they are even pregnant. And experts say a 6-week ban is tantamount to a complete ban. And there are no health exceptions in Georgia's ban. Well, Candy Miller had lupus. She had hypertension. She had diabetes. She's 41 years old. She already has three children. She found herself pregnant. Doctors had told her, your body cannot survive another pregnancy. It will kill you. So she had literally no good options under Georgia's abortion ban.
Now, can you talk about how rare medication abortion complications are, Ziva?
In about 6 million people since the FDA approved have used it, and there have been 31 deaths of any kind, only 11 of those from sepsis. It is 0.0005% of cases that are fatal, which is a lower complication rate than penicillin and Viagra. And so it's extremely safe. All medications have risk. There is a simple solution to a complication with abortion medication, and that is a DNC. And abortion ban states, for the vast majority of cases, criminalize that procedure. Mm.
I want to turn to Monica Simpson. You're executive director of the Georgia organization Sister Song. Can you talk about the levels of Black maternal mortality in Georgia?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me this morning. We are devastated to hear this news and to see that Black women are still not being treated in the ways that they need to by our healthcare system in Georgia. What is real in the state of Georgia is that we are in a maternal healthcare crisis in our state. We are a state that has yet to expand Medicaid, which means that thousands upon thousands of people are already falling under the radar and not getting access to the care that they need. And on top of that, we are dealing with the fact that we are in this country seeing Black women die at a rate 3 to 4 times higher than white women in childbirth, right? So we look at that and coupled with the fact that Georgia has a desert of OBGYN availability in our state. There are over half of our states that do not, excuse me, half of our counties that do not have access to an OBGYN. So people are having to travel miles upon miles just to get care. So when you bring all of that together in this context of a state that is also dealing with a 6-week abortion ban, Sister Song is the lead plaintiff in that case against our state. We have been fighting that for many years now, trying to get this ban removed. We are seeing a really dire picture for Black women and for people in general in the state of Georgia.
In this case that ProPublica talked about today, the story of Candy Miller. Monica, Candy Miller's health was so fragile. I'm reading the first sentences. Candy Miller's health was so fragile, doctors warned having another baby could kill her. So she was already at high risk. Her previous pregnancy was high risk, but she was terrified to go to the doctor. Talk about that, what this means, and the number of women who may be suffering or have died that we don't know. It's because of their fear of going to the doctor that they would be criminalized.
Absolutely. We hear this story far too often that we know too many Black women in particular, right, are saying that they do not feel safe when they go to their doctor. They don't feel as if they're listened to. They don't feel as if they're trusted. We have seen this this show up in the lives of people who are celebrities like Serena Williams, right? So if we have people who have the amount of privilege and resources that Serena Williams has, and they are still not listened to and trusted by healthcare providers, imagine what that looks like on the ground for everyday people who are trying to get access to care. In our membership, we get these stories all the time that we don't feel like we're trusted. We don't feel like we're going to get access to the information that we want. And so it silences people. And we know that that silence then drives people inward, and it does not allow them to be able to move towards the solutions that they need for themselves and their families. So this is a really sad day in the state of Georgia. Our elected officials need to be on top of this more than ever. And we have to take this very seriously, because we knew, and we have been saying since the Dobbs decision and even before then, that when you remove access, restrict access, ban access to life-saving care, health care that people need, then those who have historically been pushed to the margins will be the ones most affected. And we are seeing that in the state of Georgia, where these Black women have lost their lives to a preventable issue that could have been taken care of in real time.
At the Democratic Convention, a ceremony roll call to nominate Kamala Harris as president included Kate Cox speaking for Texas. She'd spoken out after she was forced to flee Texas to get abortion care after learning her pregnancy was not viable. She was introduced by former Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards, who had an op-ed in the New York Times this weekend, headlined, "Harris is good on abortion rights. Now she needs to take it to 11. Other featured speakers included three other women impacted by abortion bans: Hadley Duvall of Kentucky, Amanda Zarosky of Texas, Caitlin Joshua of Louisiana. This is Caitlin Joshua.
2 years ago, my husband and I were expecting our second child. Our daughter, Lauren, couldn't wait to be a big sister. I was getting ready for her fourth birthday party when something didn't feel right. Two emergency rooms sent me away. Because of Louisiana's abortion ban, no one would confirm that I was miscarrying. I was in pain, bleeding so much my husband feared for my life. No woman should experience what I endured, but too many have. They write to me saying, "What happened to you happened to me." Sometimes they're miscarrying, scared to tell anyone, even their doctors. Our daughters deserve better. America deserves better.
Caitlin Joshua is an African-American woman. Ziva, you mention her case in both your ProPublica articles.
Yes. Well, obviously, as has been noted by your other guest, the burden of this issue falls heaviest on Black women and women of color. I think it's very interesting to note that there have been literally dozens of cases like hers across the country where women have had a rush across state lines, have been denied care. There are now two confirmed deaths in an abortion ban state that have been ruled preventable by an official committee, including 10 doctors. Both are Black women. I don't think it's an accident that we're seeing this pattern. I think there are more cases out there. ProPublica is certainly interested in hearing from people whose loved ones may have died, who have questions about how they died, and we are going to keep looking into them.
I wanted to give Monica Simpson the last word. Cecile Richards had spoken at the DNC. She actually is suffering from brain cancer right now. And in this